Psalm 74. The Jerusalem has been devastated. This is the background. None of the Psalms lead to the next one, so they're all totally different. Judah's enemies mock Jerusalem's God, and the psalmist wonders why God, who conquered the chaos, doesn't intervene. But he allows the fury of the enemies to prevail. We're in the same mentality. God created the blooming world and conquered chaos. Why can't he conquer the Assyrian army? Why doesn't he come in and have an earthquake or a plague and get rid of a lot of them? Why don't the goodies always win? Do you get me? Why is God so angry against his people? Well, God must be angry against us because we're losing the war. And if we've lost the war, God organized us to lose the war. We must have done something wrong, you get it? So, let's find out what we did wrong. And by the way, there are still people who talk like that. Those people who were killed by the tsunami, they must have been doing something wrong. Maybe they're Muslims that were killed. The stupidity of that just drives me balmy, but anyhow.
Someone fundamentalist in Indonesia said this on television. They said that God sent the tsunami because the Aceh people would not accept Sharia law.
Right. Okay, Indonesia, yeah, that's it. So God got rid of them. I mean, it's totally sick, but it's well and truly alive. Well, that's why it's alive, because people have got the idea that God's up there running everything instead of loving everything. And love's a bit different from control, as you all know. To love means to inspire. God isn't doing nothing. God is respecting freedom. It's a very dangerous thing to do, but there's no other way to do it. And we all have to learn to do that. So, why is God saying, why does God not come and protect the downtrodden and the poor who cry for help? It's a very reasonable point of view, and it's very common, and we still have it in many, many ways. Why is this person, why is my daughter dying? She's got two little kids and she's dying of cancer, and people will leave the church over that and curse God over it because they've got this idea of God, okay? It's likely that this psalm was composed in response to the destruction of the city and temple in 587 BC. That's a very likely setting for it. You've got to get some setting for it, and that's a likely one. The language is reminiscent of the Lamentations. There are also similarities with a lamentation on the destruction of Sumer and Ur, which can be found in the ancient Near Eastern texts, which I don't have handy here, but you might have them. In other words, There's a psalm, a hymn, a song in Akkadian language, nothing to do with it, about the destruction of Ur, and it's very like this psalm. So we're in a worldview thing. And the Jews, Israelites, lived within that worldview. They had their own perception of it, but they still lived in their worldview. And that proves it. So to take it a step further. It makes no sense that God would allow to be undone what he himself has done. To reject what he's chosen. We're the chosen people, the author is. We're getting rejected. Doesn't make any sense. And these Moabites who worship false gods, or whoever they are, Assyrians or Babylonians, they're winning. It makes no sense for God to repudiate what he's redeemed, to choose his dwelling and then let it be burned, to consecrate it and then let it be profaned. Okay, we human people can sometimes fail, but God is the Almighty God and he's on our side. Why isn't he doing something? Fair enough? Question clear? Psalm, oh God, why do you leave us abandoned? Why do you blaze with anger against the sheep of your pasture? There's the psalm now. The rest was introduction. That's the psalm. And don't feel bad if you feel like this, by the way. You're allowed to feel like it, but your faith then needs to come in and say, wait a minute. Or someone needs to say, to help you, help me, think differently about it. Theology is all about thinking appropriately in the light of revelation. Do you get me? And some people's theology is so bunkum. I'll tell you one example. When I was chaplain at New South Wales Uni, and this dear mother had a little child up in the hospital that was really sick, and the child died, and this pastor or social worker or, you know, but a religious person, thank God, not a Catholic, but anyhow, said, oh, well, you obviously didn't pray enough or your child wouldn't have died. I mean, I don't believe it. I'm getting even emotional telling you about it, but I'm telling you that's what happened. There are religious people in this world who talk like that. Do you get me? To pressurize people. You cannot believe it. You can't believe it. But the point is, it's absolutely wrong, apart from being cruel. It's wrong. But obviously that person thought they were doing the right thing, and you should have prayed more, and if you only joined us and became one of us, you'd be saved. And so that goes on. It still goes on. It goes on in a big way still. And you wonder why so many people give Christianity the flick. If that was the only Christianity I knew, do you know what I'd be doing? Do you know what you'd be doing? Our brains would say, well, if that's what Christianity is, ta-da! I hope. But it's not like that. So here it is. You get the question, don't you? You get the feel of it. There's plenty of texts in the scripture that make the same kind of thing. And our psalm goes on. Remember your congregation. The edat, the assembly, the ecclesia, the church, the gathered people, which you acquired long ago, which you redeemed to be the tribe allotted to you especially. God's the God of the whole creation, but you wanted us. We're yours. We're specially chosen by you. Remember Mount Zion, where you came to dwell. Mount Zion, are you with me? That's Jerusalem. But from the point, not geographically, but Mount Zion is Jerusalem from the point of view of the place where the temple is and where the Davidic king reigns. So it's got a religious, political aspect rather than the simple geography of Jerusalem. Direct your steps to where everything lies in ruin, says to God, to the devastation that the enemy has caused to your sanctuary. The sanctuary of God has been obliterated, destroyed. So I think we are talking about 587 BC, very likely. I can't understand it. Because that means, it either means the God of the enemy is stronger than our God, you get it? Because they run in their country too, which they can't comprehend. Or it means we've done something absolutely so terrible that God has to wipe us out so we'll learn and start again. The tsunami, you know. Well, so we'll have to do Sharia law or all become Christians. Or the city, however, was also, the only other time we know the city was destroyed in this period was by the Syrian forces in the early 2nd century BC. That's the time of the Maccabees. So the Psalm 74 could apply also to this later period, when the city was devastated, and that's the story of the Maccabees, I'm sure you've read it, under the Syrian forces in the early 2nd century. And just to show you that, let me read you from 1 Maccabees, which is about that period. Chapter 4, verse 37, describes what happened then. All the army assembled and went up to Mount Zion. This is after they got rid of the Syrians, Maccabees, Judas Maccabeus. There they saw the sanctuary desolate, altar profaned, the gates burned. And in the courts they saw bushes sprung up as in a thicket or as on one of the mountains. They saw the chambers of the priests in ruins. Just saying that the psalm pretty well describes that, but it also describes the earlier destruction back in when they came back from exile in 520, 518, 517 in dribbles. And they saw the temple, they would have had a similar experience. Verse 4, your foes have filled the place of the assembly with commotion. They've set up their standards there. They've hacked their way in as one would take an axe to the thickest part of the forest. And then with hatchets and hammers, they smashed all its carved work. They set your sanctuary on fire. They desecrated the dwelling place of your name, bringing it to the ground. They said, exterminate the whole nation. Burn all the meeting places of God in the land. And describing the earlier scene, This is Isaiah 64, that is the people coming back from the exile. Again, our chapter 64, verse 11 of Isaiah, our holy and beautiful house where our ancestors praised you has been burned by fire. The places we loved most have become ruins. So your psalm and your history are kind of about the same. I mean, one of them could have written the psalm. Verse 9. We do not see our emblems. There's no longer any prophet. There's no one among us who knows how long this will last. Prophecy, please, I hope you're familiar. Prophecy, do not immediately think prophecy is about the future. In fact, it's never about the future. Prophecy in the Bible is always about now, including the implications of our present behavior on our future. Our kids' future, our grandkids' future, and the foreseeable future. They're never about the future. God help us, they're going to know nothing about it. They're not the slightest bit interested in it. They're talking to real people about the decisions we need to make now, which will have an effect on our lives and our kids' lives and our grandkids' lives. And if you read through the prophets, you find whenever they talk about the future, it's always in poetry, and it's always a statement about God, not about us. It's about the fact that even if we muck it all up, God will remain a God of love, a God of compassion, and the lamb will lie down with the lion, and the child will put his hand on a viper's, you know, all that. Peace, God will never go back on offering us peace in the future, but their focus is now. So, there's no prophet, there's no one now to stand up and, as a significant person whom we trust, and from prayer, tell us what's going on. There's no theologian who can make sense to us. How long, O God, is the foe to scoff? Is the enemy to revile your name forever? Why do you hold back your left hand? Why do you keep your right hand in your bosom? Why do you sit on your hands? What do you got your hands in your pockets for? Do something for us. Yet, and he remembers, and he uses this mythological language. Don't take it literally, for heaven's sake, it's poetry. You, O God, are my king from of old, bringing saving help to the land. You divided the sea by your might. Two images flash into your mind. The original sea, you know, the chaos. And God separated the waters above from the waters beneath. So God's creative action was a dividing of chaos, creating space for creation and all the rest of it. But not only that, the similar image, but now vertical image, they walked through the Red Sea with sea to the left and sea to the right, same symbolic mythological imagery. You divided the sea. You broke the heads of the dragons in the water. You've got the Loch Ness Monster in your right hand and some other, well, I don't know, there might be one of those, I hope there is, and you bash their heads. You know this mythology of Tiamat and Apsu and the snakes and the whole things and the blood and the, it's all stuff. The Greeks pinched off them and they got it from someone else, and it's mythology. It's dreamtime stories of the Aborigines. It's that type of language. You crushed the heads of Leviathan. You gave him as food for the creatures of the wilderness. Dragons, as I've explained, seems to refer to Rahab, who's the mythological sea serpent, and Leviathan is a monster of chaos in Canaanite mythology. And you find it in other texts. Isaiah 51 talks about Rahab, and Psalm 136 is about God's power dividing the sea. Job, Psalm, is that all right? I won't read them to you now, but they've got this language as clearly part of their world view. 15. You cut openings for springs and torrents. You dried up ever-flowing streams. So God sometimes steps in to punish people and dries up the wadis. There's no water, no rain. 7 years without rain. And what have we done wrong? So we've got to repent and all that, and then if we're nice, God will say, all right, we'll change the weather for you. And the weather patterns you scientists might actually think more. I'd rather listen to a scientist than a theologian about weather. Is that all right? I got a feeling I'm on better ground. So you might, instead of praying, you might put some money aside to research the thing and see what's happening with the warming of the planet and whatever else we might be doing. And God is very happy for thinking with our heads. Yours is the day, yours the night. You establish the moon and the sun. You've fixed all the bounds of the earth. You made summer and winter. And do you get it? So why can't you do something about this? Reasonable prayers, common prayers. We all pray them at times. That's one of the loveliest verses. I love that verse in Genesis 8:22. This is after the flood. Sorry. Yeah, it's after the flood. As long as the earth endures, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease. So it's the re-establishment of order after the misadventure of the flood. Thanks to Noah, we didn't get completely wiped out. It's the power of one. One just person actually allowed God to save the world. And then God said, well, look, I promise I'll never flood it again. No more tsunamis. I'll never flood the world again. I'll do it with fire. So they thought, what's he going to do it with fire? So fire becomes the big image then. Hell, fire, and until Dante got in the road and had hell as a freezing place. They're all images. Yahweh, verse 18, remember this. See how the enemy scoffs and how a foolish people reviles your name. Do not deliver the life and hopes of your turtle dove to the wild animals. When you wake up in the morning, I presume, next to your wife, you probably say, listen, turtle dove, I'll just go out and get the cup of tea for you, darling. You just lie there. It's a kind of a little cuddly. The turtle dove, so they saw themselves as this spring, whatever you do with turtle dove. And the gentle one that God has chosen, the peace. Don't deliver us to these wild animals, these Assyrians and barbarians and things. The dove is the Israel's heraldic emblem. You see that in Psalm 68, which we've already done. The wings of a dove covered with silver, its pinions with green gold, that's their flag. Okay, verse 19 then, a beautiful conclusion. Do not forget the life of your poor forever. Have regard for your covenant, for the dark places of the land vomit forth violence. Pretty powerful. Does the New Revised Standard Version have it as powerfully as that? Verse 20 of Psalm 74.
Have regard for your covenant, for the dark places of the land are full of the haunts of violence.
Full of the?
Haunts.
Haunts of violence, yeah. Well, for reasons I can't remember now, but when I went back to the Hebrew, helped by my dear friend who's in heaven now, Luis Alonso Schurkel's Spanish and Latin and commentaries, the image behind it is vomit forth, which I think is stronger than and worth holding. Don't let the downtrodden be defrauded. Let the poor and needy praise your name. Rise up, O God, plead your cause. Not your cause, which is about justice, of course. Remember how the impious scoff at you all day long. Don't forget the clamour of the foes, the uproar of your adversaries that's becoming ever more strident. So they're desperate. Do something now.